Welcome to Econ Talk, Conversations for the Curious, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. I'm your host, Russ Roberts of Shalem College in Jerusalem and Stanford University's Hoover Institution. Go to econtalk.org where you can subscribe, comment on this episode, and find links and other information related to today's conversation. You'll also find our archives with every episode we've done going back to 2006. Our email address is mail@econtalk.org. We'd love to hear from you. Today is July 28th, 2022, and my guest is the novelist Amor Towles. In 2011, at 46, he published his first book, Rules of Civility. It was a big hit. It was followed in 2016 by A Gentleman in Moscow, and then in 2021, The Lincoln Highway. All three books are very different and extraordinary in their own way. I read them all in about a month, having no time for any of them, but read them anyway. Couldn't put them down. I would say that for me, A Gentleman in Moscow is in a special class, and that book is our subject for today. Amor, welcome to Econ Talk.
Thanks for having me, Russ.
We're going to avoid serious spoilers, though I do encourage everyone to read the book before listening, and then come back to this after you've read the book. I want to start with the mechanics of writing. Faulkner once described writing a book as getting, quote, the character in your mind. Once he's in your mind and he's right and he's true, then he does the work himself. All you need to do is trot along behind him and put down what he does and what he says. Does that work for you? I'm not sure it worked for Faulkner, by the way. I think he liked to pull the legs of reporters and students. It may not be an accurate description of how he wrote his books, but do you write your books that way?
I think there's an aspect to what Faulkner describes for all writers. And I often find that writers who speak about that phenomena probably overstate it relative to their own work. And the reason I say that is from my standpoint, and we can generalize it from there, but is from my standpoint, I am an outliner. So I'm a designer. So when I come up with an idea for a novel, I will spend several years designing the book, which means that I'll take a premise. In the case of A Gentleman in Moscow, it's a very simple premise. It's on the cover of the book. I'm not giving anything away. It's a man gets trapped in a hotel for a long period of time. That's the notion that I had one day. And very quickly, I thought to myself, oh, you know, that would be an interesting book. It could be set in Russia. It could be an aristocrat who's sentenced to house arrest in a fancy hotel across the street from the Kremlin. And it could span from the Revolution to the Cold War. You know, all that was sort of notions that I had within seconds of the idea of a guy trapped in a hotel. Now, once I have a notion like that that captures my interest, I will spend a few years imagining it. What happens? Who are these people? What are the settings like? What are the events? What does it sound like? What are the issues at play? What's the minutia that might be a part of this canvas? And that involves not only dwelling on it and thinking about it, imagining it, but ultimately filling notebooks with potential passages for the book once I get around to writing it. Once I've fully imagined the book after a period of years, then I outline it in some detail, having that knowledge now in hand. To me, that outline is 30, 40, 50 pages, so it's quite detailed. Mm. And then I begin the process of writing chapter one. So this is a long way of saying, and I'm going to talk about what Faulkner says, you know, we're going to shift to that. But as a starting point, I start with a very comprehensive understanding of the material, the events, the people, the settings, the beginning, the middle, and the end of the novel itself. That's going to evolve while I write, of course, for a variety of reasons, but it's not as if I wind up the toy and then watch it go, you know, sort of in the way that Faulkner describes it. Now, having said all that, there's no question that when the work is going well, when you talk about individual characters, you do immerse yourself into their identity and you fuse with that. And they can then sort of guide events, language, conversations, insights. And, you know, I think as a very specific example of this, when I travel around the country in the United States or when I receive emails from readers, you know, if you go to amortowles.com and you go to the contact page, it comes to me, the message. And People will send me notes saying, listen, this passage, A Gentleman in Moscow, was particularly insightful to me or particularly meaningful to me or thought-provoking, and I shared it with my husband, or I wrote it down and it's on my computer screen right now, or I called my daughter and read it to her. 99% of the time when someone says that, the passage that they're describing that affected them, that was insightful, is something that I never would have said in the course of my own life. I wouldn't say it to my kids, wife, my friends. It wouldn't occur to me. And what's happened is that I have created a person, a character, with a background that I do not have, and a personality I do not have. I have put them in a situation in which I have never been. And when that personality with that background confronts that situation as I'm writing, sometimes suddenly the character will say, looking around, the thing about what X is da 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 da. That kind of thing comes very quickly. And usually at the end of it, I kind of hit the period and say, well done, Count. What an interesting, what a fascinating insight, And because you would not have it yourself. So now Faulkner is obviously talking about this in a broader sense, but and that's true too. You can have a moment where a character changes the course of your plan because you suddenly, it becomes clear even as you're writing it, I would never, the character's like saying, I would never do this, And so you're like, oh, in my first novel, Rules of Civility, one of the central characters is a character named Eve, who's sort of a troublemaker in New York City. In the mid-30s, she leaves the city after some sort of turmoil. And in my outline, after many years of thought, she was going to go home to Indiana. And the parents were going to meet her at the train station in Chicago. And literally, as I'm writing, two-thirds into the novel, the scene where she's arriving at the train station, that was the same kind of thing. It was like, Eve would never go home to her parents. She might say she's coming. And so what ends up happening is that she just stayed on the train and goes all the way to Hollywood in 1938. And the parents end up calling her friends in New York saying, what happened? She didn't get off the train. And, and that is the personality of the character taking over in a meaningful way. And I ended up writing 6 short stories about Eve in Hollywood, because she dragged me into that hemisphere, anyway, so yes, I am fundamentally a planner, a designer, an outliner. But in the best of conditions, when you're in the work, the subconscious takes over, the poetic aspect of yourself takes over, and you start to invent things on the fly that change the course of your plan. And I will make one more point on this, Russ, which is that because I talk a lot about my outlining, people ask about it and I talk about it. What is counterintuitive, I think, for many, is that the reason I'm an outliner, a designer, a planner, is because by being careful about outlining, when I am writing a chapter, it allows the right side of my brain, the creative, imaginative, dreamlike side of the brain, to take over and influence the writing of the sentences and the paragraphs, the imagery, the language, the word choice that infuses and brings the work to life. And the reason that's so critical is because if I don't know what's going to happen in a chapter, then the left side of my brain has to kind of take over the process, which is that meaning that they have to say, I have to be thinking about, wait, what's going to happen next? What does this room look like? The character who's just arrived, where are they from? What's their name? What state are they from? So you're suddenly going through this list of mechanical inventions that aren't the spirit of what you're writing, but are critical to what you're writing. And so by deciding all that stuff in advance, I can enter the scene and really write it from the perspective of poetry rather than the perspective of, filling in blanks.
There's a new book out called The Method, which is about Stanislavski and modern acting, which is very Russian. But part of what you're talking about is you inhabiting the main character's head. Count Rostov is the main character. And I'm curious if it ever affected your wife. Did she ever say, you're starting to sound a lot like Count Rostov?
Okay. No, I don't. My personality doesn't tend to get shaped by my characters very much, and nor do my characters get shaped by my personality, I hope. But of course, there are I wish I were more like the Count, you know, so maybe that's a way of answering. My wife wishes I was more like the Count, you know, so yes, he's an admirable figure and has a great sort of way about approaching the life and a great temperament.
Yeah.
And so maybe the process of writing about him, I am maybe a little bit, I'm a little bit more like the Count than I was before I started the process, but I wish it was a bigger leap.
Yeah. Your memoir will be called Not Quite a Gentleman in New York, but
yeah, but right.
Close maybe. He's an exemplar, which is reason his, you know, his the title of the book is A Gentleman in Moscow. He's not just a man in Moscow. He is an admirable and enviable person in his character. It's a very impressive, incredibly impressive performance. Do you have a writing regimen when you're writing a novel? Do you write every day? Do you write a certain number of hours every day, or do you have a plan? Minutes, pages?
Yeah, I do have a regimen. I am interrupting my regimen for you, Russ.
You're very kind.
I'll tell you that right now.
I'm really sad.
Because of our time change. Because my normal behavior is to be at my desk at 8 and you know, roughly 8:30, and to work up until say noon or 12:30, at which point I will go out and have lunch by myself and either edit the morning's work or in notebooks start to imagine or craft tomorrow's, you know, say new chapter or what have you. And so for me, it's really about punching the clock. It's not about a word count. It's not about, you know, chapter targets, you know, although some of it's nice to sort of have a, in the back of your mind, I'd love to get this done in the next year or two or whatever your time frame is, to, so you kind of keep, you don't sort of spin your wheels on a single chapter for 2 years. But basically, it's really about punching the clock. And so I will, that's the way I'll work.
Yeah. Hours in the chair. I like that. Yeah. Stephen King's book on writing, I'm not a big Stephen King fan, he's all right, but his book on writing is quite, I think, thoughtful, and he similarly works a fixed amount of time. Hemingway liked to say that you should always stop writing when you know what's going to happen next, meaning that when you come back the next day, you're not starting from scratch, out of the blue, cold. And that starting at 8:30 each morning can be challenging. Do you follow that rule in any way? Is that meaningful to you?
Oh, I mean, I don't think of it as a rule, but I agree with the merits of his observation. You know, I think we all understand it. But yes, I will try to have a sense of what I'm going to be working on tomorrow before tomorrow comes, because there's nothing worse in punching the clock and not knowing what you're going to do with your time. And you know, it's the most frustrating thing as an artist of all. And it can turn into depression like that. You know, sort of wear you down.
The blank page.
So yes. Yeah, so I do think about what is going to happen tomorrow. I love to end the day with sort of some quick sketches of, oh, right, you know, as you're describing, you know, the next thing that's going to happen is they're going to do this. They're going to go into this place, have this conversation. You know, maybe I know that from my outline, but I'm beginning to get sort of a better sense of sort of the charisma of that moment, let's say, and or the language of it, and taking notes for myself to that purpose so that the next day I can go right into it. Now, another version of this is that, as I mentioned a second ago, at lunch, I may either edit the morning's work or begin note writing by hand about the next day. That's a very productive way to start, too, because the transfer of material I wrote yesterday by hand into a Word document first thing in the morning is a way of getting started, because I'm going to start to refashion those paragraphs. So that's going to take some creative work. But kind of as I'm doing that, I'm beginning to get a sense of, oh, right, this what's going to happen right after this is this, or this is going to come a little bit later. And so that kind of sends you propulsively forward. So as I say, starting the day with a few pages of handwritten notes, even, you know, literally not necessarily bullet point notes, but I mean like actually stabs at getting the first four paragraphs of the chapter, that's hugely valuable, because the transition into the Word document is another way of launching.
Yeah, I find editing. Good writing is often just good editing, and editing what you wrote the day before or the morning is a powerful way to get your head back into the experience. You are the source, I suspect, of a great deal of envy and unease for people. You wrote your first novel, or published your first novel, at 46 years old. That's very rare. You were not at that time a English professor. You were an investment banker. That's an extraordinary career arc. I don't know if I can think of too many others. Wal Stevens was an insurance agent. He wrote his poetry at the same time. But you investment banked, quit, wrote your first novel, and then became a full-time writer. How much writing were you doing as an investment banker, and how did you pull that off? Rules of Civility is a masterpiece, by the way. You could argue, I hope it becomes under consideration for the great American novel. I think that's what you were aiming for, and you could argue you succeeded. It's an extraordinary book about American mores, personalities, philosophy, and so on. But you wrote that book at night, at lunch? How'd you do that?
Well, I should start by saying that I began writing fiction as a kid. I wrote fiction in high school. I wrote fiction when I was at Yale as an undergraduate. I had a fiction writing grant at Stanford, where I wrote fiction there. I moved to New York at the age of 25 or so and was writing fiction when I arrived. I had some stories in the Paris Review at that time. But I was feeling a little lonely, a little claustrophobic, broke. And so I joined a friend of mine who had started an investment firm. I was not an investment banker, although it is often reported that. We were in the investment management business. So okay. We managed money. It was a research intensive environment, managing money for high net worth individuals, endowments, foundations, et cetera, in a variety of asset classes, doing global work. And that was a fascinating and fun job. And, when I joined my partner, I was his, the first employee, as it were, and 21 years later, we were still working side by side. But in the first 10 years, I set aside the writing of fiction as we were really managing the launch of the effort, perfecting the craft as in terms of how we approached investing, beginning to recruit both clients and employees, et cetera. But eventually, I knew that if I didn't get back to writing fiction, it would really leave me very depressed as an older person. And so I began writing fiction on the weekends in my 30s, and I spent 7 years writing a book I didn't like and set that aside. But I learned a lot from that. One of the things I learned from that was that I am an outliner. I should have outlined that first book. And so I did sort of decide I'm going to do a new book, totally different material, really approach it with an outlining frame of mind so I can achieve what I want to achieve artistically. That was Rules of Civility. That was published while I was still a partner at the firm. And when that became a bestseller, that's when I retired. So yeah, it was a long road to having Rules of Civility, but it was the byproduct of a life of writing and reading.
After that first book failed, which is, I assume, I don't know if that was your assessment or the outside world's.
No, it's mine.
That's what it sounded like. That's 7 years. Kind of demoralizing. You said you learned a lot, but a lot of people would have said, what I learned is I'm not a novelist, and gone home and said, I'll make a living. I'll take care of my family. That's enough. What happened there? How'd you get the courage or the confidence to believe that you could write a serious novel that would be of interest to other people?
It's a complicated answer. This requires a complicated answer. The truth of it is that, and I think anybody who had artistic ambitions as a young person probably went through a similar experience as what I'm about to describe. But I wanted to write fiction in first grade. I wanted to write fiction and poetry as soon as I could read. I wanted to write. And those two things developed side by side over the course of my life. I would read something, write something, just kept moving forward. It was always in parody. But it was always what I wanted to do more than anything else. And when you are a young person and that's your ambition and you're investing time and effort into the pursuit of that craft, even as a kid or as a young teenager, what have you, there is inevitably this constant shift between confidence that, I can do this, I understand this. And you would read, a peer's story and you'd say, no, that's all wrong. And, you'd write your own and say, this is closer to what it should be. And you'd read someone you admire and say, yeah, I can, I understand what they're doing. I think I can aspire to do achieving what Melville's doing or what have you. You read a mediocre novel and you're like, I'm definitely doing better work than that. You know, so there's this side of a young person can have that kind of belief in themselves. Now, but the other part is that you're also saying to yourself all the time, I'm deluded. Yeah. I am totally deluded. This is a you know, figment of my imagination. What, how could I possibly know whether I can do this? And so, but those two aspects of your internal life are very present on an ongoing basis. And now along the way, you know, maybe you write something in high school and your English teacher says, oh, that's good. And, you know, whatever, you win a prize or, you know, in some small way or whatever, you get patted on the back and, you know, that's fine. What ended up happening to me is I went to Yale. I got into a writing seminar with a guy named Walter Abish, who died recently. He was a great modernist and I did work with him. And then when I was a junior, Peter Matheson, who's a great American novelist, naturalist, you know, figure in general, cultural figure in general, came to teach for a semester at Yale, and he was probably in his 60s at the time. And so I got into his seminar. You know, you would submit stories to get in. He set it up so every week he would ask a few people to read the story out loud, and then the class would talk about it. You know, the seminar would talk about what they just heard. And there was early in the semester, it was basically that there was 3 weeks in a row where I was one of the people he asked me to read my story. And at the end of the class, he said, hey, listen, could you stay for a minute? And so I stayed and everybody left. And he said, listen, I don't know anything about you. I don't know who you are. I don't know why you're here. I don't know what you want. But based on the work I've seen, I think you may be gifted at this. And as a result, I'm going to take your time here very seriously. And I would hope that you're going to take your time with me very seriously too. And, you know, that was a very, that was a big turning point. Because then you're talking about, it's not your mother saying, oh, what a nice story. It means nothing. You know, it is someone that you admire. I loved his writing. I loved him as a person. Looked up to him immediately and saying, you know, I think that there's something here and that should be taken seriously. And you know, in a way, there's a covenant with that. And that's what he's really talking about, right? Yeah. So he's saying, I am going to invest. I'm going to pay particular attention to the work you're doing, and I expect the same in return from you. So that, as I say, in all young artists' lives, there's probably a moment like this, and it comes from somebody somewhere that takes at that point, more than a decade, or we'll call it a decade of both aspiration and concern of delusion, and clears the landscape a little bit. And, you know, you say, okay, maybe I am on the right track here. And you don't need someone to say that to you as a young artist all the time. You don't need a lot of people and you don't need it all the time. You need like one really good person, and you can live off of that for like a decade. And just, you can keep returning to it in your mind and as a reminder. And both the encouragement, the objective observation that you think the person's had, but also the covenant aspect, right? Which is that, okay, you know, I'm not going to let Peter down. So, you know, and that kind of gets you going. Now, by the time, you know, and then I, as I said, I had stories in the Parish Review. I got into Stanford in the writing program. And so you're getting other benchmarks down the road that reinforce your hope that you can do this at a high level. And that kind of gives you momentum. So when you write the failed book, you have to draw on all that. You have to say, I know I can do this, you know? And so I didn't do a good job this time. And you know, what am I going to quit? You know, what would Peter say about that? You know, and what would I myself, what would that, after 30 years of investment in time and effort and
dreaming.
Yeah. I'm going to quit. And then I'm like, what 20 years from now, what is the older me going to look back and say about that, you know, about the quitting? And so you kind of pick up and you get going. Now, obviously it helps a little bit if what you've just been through, you can stop for a second and think about it. And you start to, the fog starts to clear and you say, oh, right. You know, here's something that went wrong in this effort. Because that starts to also, you start to get more excited about the next effort, right? Is that, because you can start to see, I know enough about writing that, you know, at that point that I can solve this puzzle. because you're right. The big distinction here was that it's a novel instead of short stories. I had already mm-hmm. proven my ability in short stories. So the question is, can you take that capability in short form and translate it into a longer project, which is a very different artistic task? And it should be within your grasp, right? I mean, it should be. There are a couple of short story writers who never approach the novel or try it and quit and stick with short stories because they think it's beyond them. But most novelists have written short stories and started there. And, you know, so there's a natural kind of runway between the two art forms.
Yeah, except most of my favorite short story writers, I don't love their novels. I like them, but I love their short stories. And
yes,
I can't help but think of, it's a tawdry analogy, I apologize, but there's a story that I think is mostly true, that Fred Smith was having trouble making payroll in the early days of FedEx, and he went to Chicago to his bankers. He's in Memphis. He went to Chicago to his bankers for another loan, and they said no. And he was going to have to go back to Memphis and tell his employees that, you know, it's a lovely idea, but we're out of money. Can't pay you. Go home, find another job. It's over. And he was sitting in the airport in Chicago, and he saw there was a flight leaving soon to Reno. He got on it, and he evidently took some money from his sisters in his trust, not quite with their permission. There was a lawsuit later, but he took some of that money and put it on Red or 17 or whatever he did, and made enough money in Reno to keep his payroll and his team afloat. And I often think, well, you know, a lot of people made fun of that idea. Maybe if he had gone bankrupt, there never would have been overnight FedEx or all the things that we take for granted now. And there are plenty of ideas like that. The Newton, the handheld device that didn't make it. But of course, eventually they come along. But I think about you 7 years into that first bad novel that you rejected and think very well could have been the case. You would have said, oh, well. And then the world wouldn't have had the three novels we have so far and whatever else you've come to write. And I'm very grateful for your stamina. I haven't said it yet, but and I apologize for not saying it earlier, but A Gentleman in Moscow is, in my view, it's one of my five favorite novels of all time. It's clearly a masterpiece. It's everyone I've talked to loves it. I've given it away to so many people or told them to read it. And they all like it, I think, almost as much as I do. So if you're listening, I would start with, actually, I like to do them in order. I didn't, but I would encourage people to read Rules of Civility first. But Gentleman in Moscow is quite special. And one of the reasons it's special, and turn to this now, is on the surface, it's a fairy tale. And it's a beautiful fairy tale. And then somewhere, it doesn't matter where, it becomes somewhat serious. It becomes a book about more than just the man in the hotel. The Russian regime outside his window, responsible for his plight, but in theory, he's living independently of what's going on in the world outside him. He's in the hotel, starts to intrude. At first, it's a small intrusion, then a second, then a sub-theme, then a big theme, and it swells like a symphony by the end of the book. I assume that was part of the plan. Did that change that serious, very, very powerful set of observations about Soviet life that really makes it a real Russian novel and not just a novel set in Russia? How'd you plan that?
I'll start by saying that I'm not a research-driven writer, so I don't pick a topic, research it, and write it. What I do is I pick a topic that is grounded in something I have a deep familiarity with. Now, I don't speak Russian language. I don't have Russian heritage in my family. I did not study Russian history in college. But like those Americans who are interested in or fans of Russian culture, my interest began, like so many, with the 19th century Russian novels, you know, Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and Turgenev and the short stories of Chekhov, you know, this incredible Gogol, this incredible group of writers operating within a relatively small window of time, call it 50 years, where they're at least overlapping in that 50-year period and doing this incredible work that shapes, you know, the way that the art forms are sort of considered in the West, you know, and maybe the world from then on, right? And so that got me very interested, starting as a teenager and then in my 20s and 30s and reading around them. That translated into an interest, or led to an interest, in the avant-garde movements in Russia before the war. Because in Russia, before the First World War, before the revolution, you have Kandinsky and Malevich reinventing painting. They're basically inventing abstraction, the art form that will dominate the next 100 years almost in terms of high art and painting. Mayakovsky is reinventing poetry. Nijinsky and Diaghilev are reinventing dance as a form of performance and the music that goes with it. And so all this is incredible artistic foment in Russia before the revolution. And so I was very interested in sort of studying that. And then I got interested in the Soviet era. And, I share with you, Russ, a great love of Solzhenitsyn's work and an awe of Solzhenitsyn's work. You know, a love of his work is, in a way, is a weird way to say it, because the yeah. the work is so heartrending, and he's showing the worst that can happen in humanity, and having experienced it personally in the highest form of inventive artistic delivery. You know, it's really sort of this dramatic
unbelievable
experience. So, and having lived this, the challenge of going through the gulag and inventing the story and carrying it out. So I went through this process, the 19th century novelists, the early 20th century avant-gardists, the writers who were operating under the Soviet regime and sort of fighting for the right to express and the preservation of their own dignity. And I was fascinated with the whole thing, the whole picture. And so when I had this idea of, I'll write a story about a guy trapped in a hotel, that's why I immediately thought, I could set it in Russia. It wasn't fanciful. It was almost sort of, now I can take this sort of 30 years or 20 years of digesting this culture and my love and interest in it and the awe I have for it and apply it to a narrative of my own. And so now I knew right off the bat that the biggest challenge was going to be to tie two forces together into the narrative. And though the first force, the primary force, is the count and his experience. I knew that I was not going to write a new version of the Gulag Archipelago. I was not going to write a book about a guy in a prison camp. There was no point to that. And Solzhenitsyn, I would never be able to approach what Solzhenitsyn had achieved in that regard, given his personal involvement in the experience. So I wasn't going to do that. And I wasn't really interested in doing that. And so I had this other notion of an aristocrat born in the 19th century is the one who's sentenced to house arrest. And that intrigued me because the Russian Revolution was a switch in many ways. And the switch that was turned was that at the time of the First World War, Russia was the most backward of the great European nations. They were a 19th century nation at that point, whereas England and America and France and Italy and Germany had all been moving into the 20th century rapidly from the 1880s to the 1910, right? And industrialization was happening at a rapid pace in those countries and was not happening in Russia. And if you just look at what everybody was wearing, the Russians were still dressed like it was 1850, or 1780 or whatever. And in London and in the U.S., they were wearing suits. And so more than 90% of the population in Russia was peasantry. More than 90% of the population was illiterate in Russia. So you had this 19th century country with 19th century political structure, 19th century values in many ways, at the day before the revolution. That's what Russia was. And the day of the revolution, the new leadership said, we are going to jump into the 20th century. We're going to rapidly industrialize. We're going to have equal rights for women. We're going to have forced literacy. We're going to have, and our goal is going to be to become a major world power again, in essence, an economic powerhouse.
Yeah.
And so this crazy dynamic happened where you literally were backward-looking 19th century on one day and 20th century forward-looking the next. And I thought, what an interesting thing to have been this aristocrat who's raised in that 19th century value, but with the highest quality of that value in terms of us, the elements of nobility that we admire. You know, not the taking advantage of the peasants, but I mean a sense of dignity, of manners, of gentility, of having an understanding, command of high art, you know, these elements. And so what if that person was there when the switch was turned, right? And they're watching all of that be swept off the table by this new generation who has a very valid ambition, which is, let's make Russia more fair, let's make it more modern, let's make it more part of the future. But like, what a difficult moment to be standing in. So that's kind of where I'm starting. And the challenge, as I was saying, was that I knew I could depict the Count and his 19th century values and his idealism and he's living in this luxurious hotel because he's a hero of the Russian Revolution for reasons you'll learn in the book, and because he wrote a poem that they really admire. They won't sentence him to death. Instead, they sent him to house arrest across the road and kind of lived in this diminished capacity, which is sort of part advantage, part humiliation, kind of side by side. And house arrest has been in Russia forever. And so at any rate, so I knew that within the walls of the hotel, he was going to live a life very different from Russia, and that I could follow the thread of his personality, his education, his sensibility as it tried to find a new life within the walls of the hotel in a rapidly changing world. And as you say, there's a fairy tale aspect to that. That's for sure. And the challenge, going back to the challenge, was going to be, how do we take that and integrate the reality of the Soviet times in the story? If we're not going to go to the Gulag, you know, directly, and we have this, we're living this life which is obviously separate from what so many were going through at the time. How do we combine these things? You don't want the book to be strictly a fairy tale where it's as if the, you know, bad things never happened in Russia. That's a book that has no need to be written or shouldn't deserve to be written. Yeah. But on the other hand, you couldn't preserve the sensibility of the Count and sort of the arc of what he was going to go through if the book was flooded with the realities of the Soviet times. So the house arrest served the purposes in a way. I knew that I could, that the reality of the world would be fended off to some degree by the life of the hotel, where foreigners are coming and where people were living a better life than the common, you know, Russian. But there was this issue of how to bring in the outside world. So the solution for me early on was, in essence, there's going to be two narrators of the book. 90% of the book is told in the third person, which is an extension of the Count's reality. It is his tone of voice, his vocabulary, his semantics, his sentiments, his ideals, his foibles. That's all being expressed through the language as in the third person, you know, his experience is described over 30 years. However, there's about 10% of the book, which is told by somebody very different. And originally the voice shows up in footnotes.
Yeah.
And it's this person who's stepping in to say, well, yeah, you know, the Count's doing that at this time, but, you know, it should be pointed out that this is what's going on elsewhere. This is what that meant, or this is what was happening, you know, to the average citizen on that day. And you can tell from the tone of those footnotes that this other person has a more direct exposure to the challenges of Soviet life, a more cynical view of the world than the Count does,
right,
and more sarcastic and more cutting. And that voice, which initially shows up as footnotes, then starts showing up in addendums,
yeah,
at the end of chapters, telling things that are happening outside the hotel to the characters. And then it shows up in sort of major introductions to the larger chapters, you know, in 1938, 1940, you know, six or whatever it is, you know, the war has just happened. And this narrator steps in to say, okay, well, here's what happened in the Second World War rapidly. And so there was this balance. And this was the way that I tried to combine the two things. Now, I knew that the Count's route was going to be philosophical in its own right, because he starts to some degree as a dandy. I mean, no question about it. But he is going through.
Grows up.
You know what we. Yeah, he's growing. It's a book about purpose. He has to rediscover a sense of purpose and rediscover what should his relationships be like. What should his relationship to ideas and art be like? What should his relationship to work be like? Because he's never done any, you know, all this is a discovery process. And he goes from being someone who understands philosophy, ideas, and sentiment as a hobby to one who must study those really as, you know, a means of survival and understanding in a greater sense through a personal interaction. And so I knew that was going to be happening, but it was very important for that to be happening alongside this growing understanding of what's happening, you know, to the average citizen at the same time. And the Count is eventually going to understand that too and be forced to face that. And so anyway, so yes, this is kind of the notion from a philosophical standpoint of how these two different threads came together in the story.
But I would just add that if you just picked up the book, you can read it straight through, and a careless reader could not dwell too long on those more realistic intrusions. This is why it's a masterpiece. It's the story of a person in a constrained set of circumstances, but you've embedded him in world events in a way that is quite extraordinary. Before we go on, I want to, two quick things about the Count's straits. Do you remember the Chekhov story, The Bet?
Yes, but go ahead.
So I've mentioned it once, I think, before in the program, maybe twice. It's about a debate between dinner guests over whether capital punishment is more cruel than a life in prison, a lifelong sentence. And one of the guests says no. And so one of the guests says, well, life in prison is obviously better than death. And the host says, well, death is might be a blessing compared to being stuck in one place forever until you die. And so they have a bet. And the bet is the young lawyer says he can stay in a small cottage on the host's property for 15 years without leaving, accepting only food and books through an open window. And in return, if he manages to stay there, the host will pay him 3 million rubles or something. And I won't spoil what happens in the story. That's the first page. It's an extraordinary story. It's very un-Chekhovian for me. I find Chekhov quite slow. This is not slow. I've come to like Chekhov from A Swim in the Pond in the Rain by George Saunders, a great book. But anyway, I didn't think about it until just now. Your character is living out that bet. He's stuck in one place. He's under house arrest. It's a slightly bigger place than the cottage of the hero of the bet, but or the protagonist of the bet. But it's a book about, in one, you can, listeners can understand, it's a book about many things, but in one sense, it's a book about the power of constraint. And I've read you write, I've read you talking about how constraint helps you as a writer. So I'd like you to talk about that. You were stuck. You gave yourself a plot device that is a straitjacket, you know, which seems like a blunder. How could that be a good idea? And of course, your main character is stuck in that same place. Talk about constraint, how it affects your art, and how it affects your life in the case of Count Rostov.
Constraint is an extremely valuable starting point for most art.
It's underrated.
So, if we look at painting, almost no painter starts with a giant canvas, paints, and then cuts it down to, you know, some limitation, right? The painter starts with a canvas size, and that's the way they begin. And they start to imagine what's going to fill the canvas within the framework of that those very specific determined limitations, you know. And they don't take a giant piece of canvas and draw a pencil box and start to work it so they can change it later. They stick to that frame. And, you know, the sonnet is, in writing, the most famous example of a productive constraint, right? Because it's a set rule, 14 lines, iambic pentameter, rhyme schemes that are a couple of variations, but are a handful of variations that are stuck to. And the sonnet has been pursued by major poets in English, Italian, French, Spanish, from the Renaissance to now. So why is that? Why are all these writers, and who have seen the shape and possibilities of poetry evolve over hundreds of years, why do they keep returning to this set of constraints? And it really is because that the constraints are productive. They're generative. They are, in essence, the rules of a sonnet are what we would call a generative device. It's a rule that forces you to move a little bit outside your normal instincts and to adapt in a way that, again, unleashes potentially the power of your unconscious. Your focus on fulfilling the form lets things happen that it wouldn't otherwise. So as an example, in a sonnet, you might say, okay, well, I'm going to write about, the difficulty of aging. You know, it's from the perspective of someone in their 60s and they're losing their vitality and their hearing, their sight, you know, their stamina, whatever. And you know, it's bittersweet. And I want to write about that in a poem, in a sonnet. Well, that's fine. But the rules of the game will start to dictate to some degree how that comes to fruition, because the rhymes, the words you're choosing, the rhymes that have to fulfill the iambic pentameter and the rhyme scheme mean that you're going to start to pop into your head words that you wouldn't have thought to use in that context, that suddenly trigger an emotion, you know, or a sentiment that is different. You know, I'm making this up, but let's say, you know, in the end of the second line, the word is trip. And so you're like, you know, what rhymes with trip? You do ship. And you're like, oh, you know, that's so interesting, because as we think about aging in the context of going to sea, you know, what does that mean? And so that can happen suddenly where the whole vista opens up for the poet. And they're like, yes, this is what aging is. It's this, you know, like maybe like in Tennyson, it's the last, Odysseus on his final voyage, you know, whatever it is.
It little profits that an idle king by this still hearth among these barren crags. I was going to use that to let listeners know that's iambic pentameter in case they don't know.
Yeah.
But yes, we have a great coincidence here. Carry on.
Yes. So Tennyson's great, great work of Ulysses. So at any rate, that's the point of the constraints, my point here. Now, in the novelist's work or short story writer's work, these can come in many forms, and some of it's very extreme and would leave most readers, cold, because they seem like a game and the outcome of the game is maybe not as satisfying as reading Jane Austen or Tolstoy or whatever, like such as, you know, George Perec, French writer who was a member of Oulipo, who were very interested in constraints and generative devices. He wrote a novel, but a long novel, in which the letter E never appears. Now, the letter E is the most common letter in the French language, much as it is in the English language. And so to remove that from your alphabet means that you're getting rid of, you know, a very high percentage of words and whole classes of verbs and adjectives and adverbs that use, you know, the past tense, you know, relies on the letter E significantly in the United States, you know, in English, because ED at the end of a verb. So this is a challenge. Can I write a novel without using words that have the letter E in them? And that immediately forces him to write in a slightly different style than he would have otherwise, and for events and objects and personality traits to be limited to these words without the letter E. And so that becomes a thing. Now, as I say, sometimes ideally the generative device is invisible to the reader, and that it reads as if it never happened. And you're like, at the end of it, you're like, what? He did what? You know, that's ideal. You know? The less ideal is where you can kind of feel that it's not quite right. You know, the limitation is interfering with the narrative in a way that you can tell the trade is not productive for you as the reader. So both things can happen. So anyway, in A Gentleman in Moscow, there are two major constraints, I guess. The first is the hotel itself. Right, you say, well, I'm going to write the book where, for the vast majority, basically the entire book, the count is not going to leave the hotel. And I know that going in, basically as a reader, you get that from the day one, and we're going to have to go through that together. And that's that's an easy constraint for me. I'd never had a second thought about that. I wasn't anxious about it. It brings a lot of advantage to me as the writer, because I don't have to write about all of Moscow. Over 30 years, I can focus on how the world is changing through the microcosm, as, you know, the furniture gets shabby, or as the type of guests change, or the economic decisions outside influence internal events. You know, when, for instance, suddenly, they had rules that no Russians were allowed to go in foreign restaurants or hotels for a significant period of the early phase of the Russian the Soviet era. You just were, it was against the law. You couldn't go in. But then the Russian government, Soviet government, was running out of money, and they needed foreign currency to buy things in the global market, because nobody in the world would take the ruble. And so what they did is they changed the law in Russia, which said that anybody can go into a foreign restaurant or hotel, any Russian citizen, provided that they buy the services in foreign currency. Uh-huh. Because the government had realized that a lot of the citizens had foreign currency, and they were hiding it and using it in the black market effectively. And they, you know, they were keeping it to themselves. So that this way, by opening the hotels to them in exchange for foreign currency, rather than prosecuting them and trying to find the money, they gathered the money that way, and they used that to fund the Soviet government. So anyway, so as I say, that's a, you can imagine, that's a major change and a fascinating one in the political economic trajectory of the Soviet Union. And it had very specific implications when you go from one chapter to the next of who's in the restaurant.
Yeah.
You know, so as I say, so I didn't worry about that constraint. I thought that was going to be fun and interesting and serve both me and the reader. The other constraint, which is a little bit more like George Perec or the sonnet, is the time sequence of the book. So this is going to sound either crazy or boring. I apologize. But anyway, the General Moscow has a very specific time structure to it, which is that as you're reading the book, the first thing that happens is the count gets sentenced to house arrest. The book then tells you what happens to the count in the hotel 1 day later, 2 days later, 5 days later, 10 days later, 3 weeks later, 6 weeks, 3 months, 6 months, 1 year later to the day. Then it tells you what happens 2 years later to that day, 4 years later to that day, 8 years later, 16 years later to the day, from 1922 to 38. And then it reverses itself. So from there, you learn out what happens 8 years later to the day, 4 years, 2 years, 1 year, 6 months, 3 months, 6 weeks, 3 weeks, 10 days, 5 days, 2 days, to the exciting conclusion. So the sort of accordion structure is in the book. I had decided many, many years ago it would be an interesting way to design a book. As soon as I had the notion of telling the count's story, and I mean, like, you can see it on my very first page of notes, I was like, oh, I'll use the accordion structure. It's perfect for this story. And now, hopefully, and I know this is true from having talked to thousands of readers, it's invisible to you.
Yep.
You know, most
I missed it.
Yeah. You would.
It just works. It's making the poignant French cafe music anyway. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's a generative device, and it has advantages to me because you want the granular insight at the beginning of his internment. What is happening every day? But if it went and told you every day for 30 years, you'd shoot me.
Yeah.
You'd shoot me. So, but we want to start to leap ahead and see, well, what happened, you know, what happened in the Second War, or what happened, you know, when the crackdown in 38 came, or, you know, as the bigger changes are occurring and, you know, society's modernizing and Stalin is aging, whatever, you kind of want to do these leaps and get a new window on it. But as you move towards the end, you crave that granularity again, for very specific reasons that I will not go into.
Yeah.
So yes, I'm very interested in these kinds of constraints, and I think they can be very productive. As you know, my new novel, The Lincoln Highway, which came out in the fall, is a story about really a few boys on their way from Nebraska to New York City in 1954. And the whole story is only 10 days.
Yeah.
And the book is the identical length to A Gentleman in Moscow from a word count standpoint. You know, and one is a 30-year saga, one is, you know, 10-day story, and that's its own constraint of a different kind.
Sure.
One of duration as opposed to space.
I would just say this. I can't remember whether I read this and it was a review on Amazon, or a friend, probably an ex-friend now, said to me, I didn't like that book, A Gentleman in Moscow. Nothing happens. Yeah. I thought, what? Nothing happens? Man, I guess on a certain level, nothing happens. The guy's stuck in a hotel for a long time. Okay. But yeah, a lot happens, both internally and externally to the count. But that's fascinating. I want to say a little bit more about constraint. You have a line in the book, which I love. You could think of luxury as a lack of constraint, and poverty is an example of constraint. There are many things we adopt in life as constraints. I'm an observant Jew. People find that puzzling. How could you choose to restrict yourself on Sabbath for 25 hours? But at one point, Count Rostov talks about the conveniences of his life, which are basically luxuries. And he says, but in the end, it has been the inconveniences that have mattered to me most. So my question is, and that's an example of constraint, right? An inconvenience is a constraint. It's a, you know, something that could have been, just throw money at that. No, you can't, it turns out. Okay, now what? Is that true for you in your personal life, or is that just one of Count Rostov's thoughts?
It's what, well, I mean, I, like I said it before, you know, when Count Rostov has some of these thoughts, I mean, oh my God, that's so ingenious. Yes, that's so true. And you know, and the full context of that passage is, you know, is there, he's with a lover in bed, basically. And, but, you know, and he said, and she's sort of admiring things that she doesn't have, that the Americans have. And he, you know, he says, well, and they're conveniences. And he says, you know, well, I'll tell you what's convenient is, you know, is arriving late. It's going to a party, one party, and having the carriage wait outside to go to the next party. It's postponing marriage. It's not having children. You know, these are conveniences, and then in retrospect, it's the inconveniences that have mattered. And you know, this is later in the story. And so, you know, the young aristocrat who, at the age of 32, goes into the hotel and has had the ultimate in access to conveniences. Part of his life is to go through and rediscover what is important, what is meaningful, what matters to him most. And that happens in an array of ways in the story. And so, yes, I think that there's a very natural transition to go from these things that we sort of prize and love that we have access to. And then you kind of go through a transformation where you might take on something that it's less clear what its value to you is. It's more difficult to achieve. And yet suddenly you have this moment where you're like, oh my God, this is better than that easy, lovely thing I used to admire so much. Children, of course, is the greatest example of all. You know, for any of us who have children, it is nothing but an inconvenience, right? But yet people are obsessed with their children, and they fill them with joy and anxiety and all these different things and make them feel fuller as adults. And, you know, it's okay to not have children too. I don't mean to suggest that being parenthood is the be all and end all, but we've all witnessed this, that the trials of being a parent of young children in human nature. And of course the species depends upon this. We have evolved in this way. If you did not at some deep level get satisfaction from caring for an infant, you would put them on the stoop and leave them for the wolves.
Oh, for sure.
Because they drive you crazy otherwise. And so, but of course this is a part of life, as I say, is that you go some challenge is almost always essential to feeling a greater sense of fulfillment of, and you know, both in the casual sense and in the deeper sense of through learning and through self-awareness and through your connection to others and all these things that make the human experience so magnificent. And so, you know, some challenge is not an impediment to the realization of those things. It's almost an essential element to the realization of those things. And so, I think that, you know, we who are young people can have this viewpoint too, but it's certainly as you go through life, you gain a better understanding of this. And so, yes, the count going through that discovery of a very particular kind, I think it's probably shared by many. And when I say that a character says something, I'm like, oh, that's great, Count. Very often what that means is you can sense hopefully a certain universality to what the character has just said or observed. If it was just true to the count, it wouldn't resonate with me in the same way, you know? And so suddenly if the count says this thing that I wouldn't have thought of, it resonates with me, then, you know, you sort of like, oh, you know, other people might tune into that too and really connect with that. But, and that's always an interesting part of the puzzle.
In my new book, Wild Problems, which I think, will be out when this airs. I talk about the fact that if you think of your decision to have children as a utilitarian one, it's very possible that for most parents, the number of good days is vastly outweighed by the number of bad days. And you could even say that about, I think, for many people, marriage is that. There's lots of challenging days. There's lots of challenging days as a parent, certainly. And that's not why you do it. The day-to-day calculus that economists use typically of pleasure versus pain and what we call utility, I think, is missing something. And good economists realize that, but incorporating that into the models is very difficult. And I'm intrigued by that that question. And psychologists also disagree about whether, I quote Daniel Gilbert in my book, you know, all that matters is the sum of pleasure versus pain. I don't think so. unless you want to say, but the overarching pleasure of the having the identity and experience of a purposeful life from, say, parenting or something else, art, whatever it is that, that speaks deeply to you, it's hard to include that in the day-to-day summation. It's not a majority rule thing for me anyway. That it's just the number of good days versus bad days. Terrible way to think about life.
To say it's the sum of a pleasure of pain is pithy in a way that's not really productive, because as you know, as we both know, and you know, I come from a Puritan background. I mean, you know, which meaning hundreds of years ago, but the tradition in New England kind of gets handed down, and it shares certain things, I think, with the Jewish tradition in terms of a respect for sacrifice and a respect for a lack of abundance, you know, and for a lack of showiness and a lack of excess. And it turns out that that whole community found great satisfaction through denial.
Correct. Right? And there's some of that in Judaism. Judaism doesn't have that as richly as some strains of other religions, but there's a strain like that.
But anyway, it doesn't. It's not as simple as to say, you know, pleasure and pain, you know, because those things can be very much, you know, or tied together, or access and sacrifice can be tied together in different ways.
So this is the closest that we'll get to a spoiler, and if you want to shut this conversation off, you may. But there's a scene in the book where the Count discovers that the Count's a man of extremely good taste, as I suspect Amor Towles is. He knows a lot. He knows his way around a kitchen, or at least a restaurant, and a wine list. And the Count has got superb and very demanding taste for both food and wine. And at one point, it's discovered that through a decree, all the magnificent wine cellar of the Metropole has been stripped of its labels. So when the Count orders a particular kind of wine he wants with his osso buco or whatever it is in that whatever dish it is, the waiter tells him, it's simple, it's red or white, which one do you want? Even though, and this is the part that's spectacular, a red could be anything. I mean, there's some of the greatest wines of all time are down there, and then there's some not so great wines down there, but they're all called red now. And I enjoyed that as an example of Soviet malfeasance, but I didn't appreciate it until I prepared for this interview to think about that as a metaphor for the Soviet view of humanity, which I'm sure you had in mind. There's a beautiful passage where you talk about each wine being distinctive, having its own heritage, its own history, its own strengths, its own weaknesses. It goes with some things, but not others. And of course, part of the worst part of the, to my mind, of the Soviet experiment was egalitarianism, which is a virtue in certain dimensions, taken to this extreme. And in a way, it's a harmless one in this case, really. Who cares? Okay, a person without, in fact, it's nice. A person doesn't have much money happens to get one of a magnificent vintage, whereas a rich person is stuck with rot gut. But when you think about the human context, it's a little different. So talk about that if you're willing to.
So you know, this is another one of these cases of sort of the writing providing its own gifts, in that I knew I wanted the Count is going through in the early part of the novel sort of a sequence of humiliations, you know, an open-ended sequence of humiliations. He starts with the house arrest, but then he gets moved to a smaller room immediately. But then it's one thing after another. It's sort of the new world cutting into whatever, you know, the old world for him used to be. And I kind of was looking for, you know, almost a straw that would break the camel's back, you know, and what would be the thing that the Soviets would do that would just finally, you know, almost break him. And so I thought about two different things, and that's something I was like, oh, I know, so perfect, right? So what's going to happen is he's going to go to the restaurant, and as you say, the waiter is going to say, you know, he says, I'll have the Chateau Neuf de Pape 19, you know, 18, whatever. And I'm saying, oh no, sorry, sir, it's only red and white. And he's like, what, you know, get the maitre d'. He was a friend, you know, he's become friendly with the maitre d'. And the maitre says, oh, you know, Count takes him down to the cellar, and, you know, and there by decree, all the wine labels have been removed because, you know, of course,
it's unfair.
Because in the extreme sense, you know, pricing wine at different levels is not very communistic in an economic sense. It is almost, you know, built in privilege and mm-hmm. putting something out of reach of one and, you know, the best out of reach of the many and the worst in the reach of all, you know, kind of thing. So I was sort of like, I kind of came up with this notion of, yeah, that'd be like hilarious and kind of in a way fitting with some of the crazy bureaucratic decisions that were made in the spirit of true communism. And also would be so crushing to the count, who's a foodie in essence. Yeah. So I kind of know that. And I in my notes, I said, okay, that's what's going to happen. He's going to be refused the wine, and the waiter who brings the wine is kind of his nemesis. And so that's great. And, you know, maybe even the guy who brought the waiter who announced it is the guy who came up with the idea in the first place. And so there's all this kind of stuff like that. That's fitting. And I know that he's going to go down the stairs with the maitre d', see the wreckage in this giant wine cellar. And I kind of had early on this idea that the maitre d', who's a very honorable, you know, Frenchman who's living in Russia, sort of stopping at the staircase and allowing the count to walk down through the rows of delabeled bottles. And I always thought of it as like the, as in essence, the lieutenant stopping as the general is walking through the hospital after a battle, you know, lieutenant with his hands behind his back because the general is walking and seeing the carnage, you know? And so I kind of did that. And I knew that the count was going to stop, take a bottle from a rack and like hold it in his hand, like Hamlet holding the skull of York. That's why I had this vision, but I really didn't know what he was going to say, but you know, I just kind of had, I was like, oh, this is going to be great. And so you write the thing and he comes down the stairs and the maitre d' stops and he continues down the aisle and he takes the bottle in his hand. And it was really like, I was writing right up till that moment where suddenly it all came tumbling out and where the count is thinking about the individuality of wines, you know, and that's really the loss of the labels. But is, and he's thinking about the fact that the nature of wine is those of us who, and I'm not I know more about food than I know about wine, but of course, the most basic scientific fact about wine is that it is the expression of a very small acreage. And so, you know, whether your particular acre is north facing, south facing, whether it's exposed to wind or not wind, the fog or not the fog, the number of days of sun, the number of days of rain, the minerality of the soil, these are the things that ultimately lead a wine to have a particular flavor, or, you know, however you want to put that in a more sophisticated sense. And then, of course, you can take that an extra. So literally 1 acre of on Napa versus another acre that is 100 yards away versus another acre, or, you know, or 100, a square 100 yards versus one that's, you know, 100 yards away versus 100 yards away. They all are totally different in terms of the potential wine composition that comes out of them, given all these factors. But then you can add to that, of course, by saying, well, in any given year, it's different as well. So yes, the one that's from this acre will be related to any vintage from that acre over time. But in a year with more sun or more rain, that vintage will be different. And so you get sort of these, this is all going through the count's head. And as I'm writing this, I'm like, oh my God, this is it. This, you know, this is to your point. It was not planned. It was a discovery in the writing process that this is the whole Soviet mess. You know, this, the stripping down of individuality, this that makes human, you know, nature so extraordinary. And where in human nature, it is this combination of the acre we're grown up in and the weather that we're going through that turns us into very specific individuals with some relationship to those around us, but yet unique attributes. And that's of course what we're ultimately going to bemoan, you know, in the evolution of the Soviet experiment. And this is sort of relatively early in the book, and he knows it's going in that direction. And that's what's really going to break his. You know, it's not the loss of the wine is a disappointment, but it's a small disappointment compared to the recognition that we're going in a direction where individuality could be stamped out, you know, human individuality. And so, but yes, that's the fun about the writing process. As I said, if I know what's going on, then these things can present themselves in the course of the work itself.
When I send a book to my editor, which is very painful for me, that because I'm a reviser, and I've sent it for the last time, and it's over. I'm done. I made all the changes I'm going to be able to make, and it's coming out. I never look at it again. Very rarely. Very rarely do I reread a book of mine. Do you reread your? Have you read A Gentleman in Moscow since 2016? You know it very well. I just read it about 6 weeks ago, and I went through it quickly this afternoon to get ready for this. And I think, you know, often when I interview authors about their books, you know, I know better than they do because I just read it and they wrote it years ago sometimes. I don't always interview authors when their books are new. Have you read it recently?
No. But you know, it takes me 5 years to write a book and I've only written three. So, my memory, I remember novels that I read in high school, you know, that I didn't write. And so, you know, I think like a lot of reader writers, I have a very good narrative memory to begin with, and that's an advantage.
It's extraordinary.
It's an advantage. But you know, it's very different. I have many peers who are friends who are writing a book a year. And so, you know, 10 years goes by and they've written 10 books.
Yeah, they're all.
And that's very hard, you know, and that's a very, that book has made a very different impression on them and will probably make a very different impression on the reader too.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the author and the reader are both comfortable with that difference,
yeah.
You know, and I am, you know, I read mystery novels in the summer. I love it reading suspense novels and, you know, some of the great writers of those were cranking them out once a year. And, you know, after I read four, I can't remember which, right. And which one was the butler one who did it? And which one was it the mistress? You know, I don't know. But, you know, because it all kind of starts to merge together. But that's fine. It doesn't take away from the pleasure of reading it. But I do, I'm sure that for the author, it is a very different experience than, you know, where I'm living it with a greater long period of time and rereading it over and over the years,
yeah,
as I edit it. And,
that's amazing.
And that changes the way you think about it.
You recently wrote on Twitter that you're reading all the books of Georges Simenon, the French mystery writer. Do you only what else do you read now for either pleasure or profit besides mysteries?
Well, and I just do that in the summer. I'll take a suspense or mystery writer and read them chronologically, and I kind of, you know, year to year I'll change it up, and that's sort of part of a gift to myself in the summer. But normally I read with three friends. We've been reading together for almost 20 years. And we meet on a monthly basis to discuss a novel. And we read projects. So we will take an author and read, you know, 5, 6, 7 of their novels chronologically. Or we'll take a region or a time period or a theme. And we'll do multiple books on from that place, that time, that theme, whatever it is. Generally chronologically, working chronologically over, you know, half a year, and then we'll shift gears and do something new. And so, you know, we've been doing that, you know, as I say, for almost 20 years, and that's the serious reading.
Who do you love from that 20-year passage of time? Who are some of the favorites?
For instance, what we did a period where we took a year and we read a handful of Nobel Prize winners who had not written in English, and where we were not familiar with their work. So we did a sort of a series of those, and all of us, and this is the four of us, we're all very different. We're tending to read classic literature. We're not sifting through the contemporary pile. And so the hit rate is very high, you know, because you're reading things that time has filtered out as excellent. But nonetheless, even then you can have moments where there's unanimity of, oh, that was amazing. And one of those was the works of reading Naguib Mahfouz's Cairo trilogy, you know, where none of us had read Mahfouz. He's the first Nobel Prize winner to write in Arabic. The novel was not a part of the Arabic tradition at all up until the 20th century. And he was a great lover of the French and British and Russian novels and brought that sensibility to describe, the life of a family multi-generational experience in a single building in Cairo over three books. And it's just terrific, amazing work, you know, all kind of set in pre-Second World War Cairo for the most part.
So cool.
But it was just a great discovery. You know, you kind of go into a new world. The three of us did Thomas Mann for a period. And this book I'm talking about, the trilogy, Cairo trilogy, is very reminiscent in a way of Buddenbrooks, which none of us had read, and we loved. We all
really
loved Buddenbrooks.
Wow. Okay. Maybe I need to give it another shot.
It's good.
Your main character, Count Rostov, is a gentleman by description. In Yiddish, we would call him a mensch, a person who knows the right thing to do and manages to do it. A friend of mine says that the Count is the embodiment of the life well lived. Albeit one in a very constrained way, but still. Do you agree? What might we learn from him?
Well, you know, I think I think that, you know, hopefully a well-written novel can be a font of discovery for all of us, right? And let's talk about, I'm not trying to create the Countess as an exemplar. I'm not trying to create the General Moscow as a tool for better living. So let me just sort of talk about what I'm trying to do, and then we can sort of tie it to the specific aspect of your question, which is that I'm very interested in the fact that the novel at its best is in essence a machine for meaning. And if you think about the composition of a novel, what it is it's literally 1,000 elements of craft that are being brought together. And those elements of craft include, you know, elements of plot, of setting, of characterization, of sequences of dialogue, of the expression of sentiments and ideas, of, you know, there's allusion and allegory and all kinds of, you know, poetic elements that are a part of it. You know, these are all elements of craft, of the structure, like we've talked about. And then you have word choice itself and phrasing and point of view and cadence and the poetry of the language. All these are elements of craft. And a novel is literally thousands of individual choices from the elements of craft to create this work. Now, in its best, the novel, having been this assembly of elements, is an entertaining to readers of all different types, engaging for them. But the loose array of these all these different elements, which are operating in harmony in a well-executed novel, is such that people from different backgrounds, different ages, different personalities can come in and be entertained and walk away with a very different perspective of what it means. Right? Because as they're reading, they're making their own selection, consciously or unconsciously, of these different components. And by bringing these components into the fore of their mind, they're saying to themselves, you know, this book is really about personal freedom. And I can actually show you that because of this happens and this image and the recurrence of birds and you know, blah, da, 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 da. You know, and that's really what this book is about. And the person you're sitting across from at dinner could say, wait, no, you know what this book is really about? You know, and then they'll go through their version of it because as they're reading it, they're making their own associations, drawing their own connections, highlighting different components of the book in a different way. And this, of course, is why when it is done effectively, a book can survive hundreds of years in the interests of contemporary readership, right? And we read Tolstoy today with great pleasure. We read Shakespeare being the extreme example, because that's like 500 years of survival. But it's because of this dynamic that the book is entertaining, and yet the disarray of elements held together in this harmony allow for and invite a constant reinterpretation of what the text means. And this also allows people from different races and genders and social classes to enjoy the work over different periods of time. And for the same person to read the book at the age of 20, 40, and 60, to enjoy it each time, and yet walk away with a very different perspective of what it meant to them. You know, so this is really the goal, and whether I achieve it or not, time tells. But you create A Gentleman in Moscow with this as the goal, and you hope that different people are coming to it and discovering different things. And the personality count and his ethos is one element, and you hope that the richness of the book will serve and engender different insights for different people that are many of which are beyond the scope of even my understanding. You know, that's the ideal.
Well, I'm very grateful that I don't know whether I should be happy or sad, but you can tell me as to whether we've delayed the next Amor Towles novel this morning. And if so, are you willing to give us a hint as to what that is?
You know, my new novel, coincidentally, or not, maybe not coincidentally, it does start in Cairo in the 40s. I read the Mahfouz, you know, half a decade ago, but my new book starts in Cairo in the mid 40s for a very different reason and ends in New York in 1999. But that's all I'll tell you about it.
My guest today has been Amor Towles. Amor, thanks for being part of Econ Talk.
Thanks for having me, Russ.
This is Econ Talk, part of the Library of Economics and Liberty. For more Econ Talk, go to econtalk.org, where you can also comment on today's podcast and find links and readings related to today's conversation. The sound engineer for Econ Talk is Rich Goyette. I'm your host, Russ Roberts. Thanks for listening. Talk to you on Monday.